And we're talking My Science, My Religion, the latest work by Michael Cremo. Fascinating. You imagine humankind being that old? We've been around so many millions of years. I wonder what's up there on the moon. I wonder where else we've gone. Anyways, we'll come back because Michael talks about a catastrophe. We'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Michael Cremo as well. Michael, you talk about the catastrophe. Of course, didn't happen on December 21st of 2012, but you think it could happen.
It definitely will happen. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, last year I was giving lectures at universities in South India, and one of the most common questions I was getting from students was, is there going to be doomsday in 2012? They had been showing this Hollywood film, 2012, all over India, and there's some very striking images in the film. One of them is of this huge tidal wave coming up and covering all of India and rushing up to the Himalayan mountains. And there's this image of this Buddhist monk on the top of the Himalayan mountains seeing this huge wall of water rushing up, covering the whole Indian subcontinent and about to wash over the Himalayan mountains. So a lot of the students were concerned. So I told them, okay, that's going to happen someday, but not in December 2012, so you can register for next year's classes. So, according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are periodic catastrophes that do affect the Earth, wipe out life on Earth. They happen over long cycles of time called manvantars. We're now in about the middle of a manvantar, and this manvantar lasts about 300 million years. It started 120 million years ago. It's going to last for another 180 million years. So at the end of 180 million years, according to what I think, there will be a huge devastating catastrophe of the kind that have affected life on Earth every few hundred million years. You know, the last big one, according to modern science, was the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. Before that, there was another one I've been reading about in the news recently in some of the scientific reports about the catastrophe that took place a couple hundred million years before the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. Right. So there, even according to modern science, there have been periodic catastrophes that have wiped out life on this level of reality more than once, and it will happen again, but didn't happen in December 2012. I think it'll happen millions of years in the future, but it will happen.
You know, one of the things, the points that I keep looking at too, Michael, is that caldera at Yellowstone. It's way overdue.
There could be, you know, because in terms of these cycles, there are smaller cycles called yugas. And according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, we're now in what's called the Kali Yuga, which is predicted to be a time of increasing social and environmental disturbance. So there can be natural disasters that won't wipe out everything on Earth, but which can be very destructive. And you know, we've seen some happen already, earthquakes, tidal waves, tsunamis, extreme heat, extreme cold, blizzards. There could be some violent earthquakes or volcanic eruptions of a more local nature that could be very destructive. So I'm prepared to see something like that happen in the near future, but eventually there will be a huge catastrophe.
And once again, it might start all over again, Michael.
It definitely will start again.
When these events occur, these earth-changing, earth-crushing events, for example, is every creature wiped out? Is every human being at the time wiped out? And if they are, how do they start again? So my thoughts are, maybe they're not wiped out in total, but, you know, you still have that Adam Eve type person, and it starts over again.
According to the ancient Sanskrit writings, that that happens to some extent, that on during the miners' destruction cycles that occur periodically on Earth, there could be remnant human populations. There's an account that at the end of the Kali Yuga, which will take place in about 4 million years, there are people even today, personalities even today, living in a place in the Himalayan mountains called Kalapagram. It's more not so much a geographical location, but a psychical location in that region, where there are humans existing even today, that when the Kali Yuga comes to an end and the humans have mostly disappeared from Earth, they will come out again and repopulate the Earth. But in the larger destructions, all life on Earth will be wiped out. But elsewhere, higher in the cosmos, there will still be intelligent, conscious beings who are capable of repopulating the Earth from higher levels of reality. But there are even larger cycles of time when even they will be put into a state of non-existence. And then it's like a whole new creation has to take place from the Supreme Conscious Being. So but ultimately, according to what I believe and what's there in the ancient Sanskrit writings, none of us as conscious beings are really from this level of reality. We belong on a higher level of reality that is beyond all of these cycles of creation and destruction that periodically take place. By nature, we are timeless. We are not subject to destruction and creation as conscious beings. Consciousness neither comes into being nor is destroyed. And that's why we feel uncomfortable in the world of matter. We know we're in a place of danger. We always feel some bit of insecurity, whether it's financial insecurity or emotional insecurity or any other type of insecurity that we might feel in the face of the ever-changing world of matter that we exist in with its cycles of creation and destruction. We are all really ultimately beyond all that. That's why there are different systems of yoga and meditation and contemplation. They're meant to elevate consciousness to a state beyond all of these threats of different catastrophes that are always imminent on this level of reality.
Michael, what do you mean by in your work psychic archaeology? What is that?
I have become interested in this topic recently for a couple of reasons. For one thing, there are accounts in the ancient Sanskrit writings of a kind of archaeology that existed hundreds or thousands of years ago, and mostly it takes the form of some saint or mystic having a vision or a dream where they perceive that there is some sacred image lying buried in the earth. And then they go to that place and dig it up and find it. And there are places like I was just recently in India, and I was in Bengal, and I visited a place where one of these events occurred about 500 years ago. It's a remote village in Bengal, and in this village, there's a temple, and it houses a sacred image. And this sacred image was revealed in a dream to a saintly person whose name was Abhiram Thakur. And it was revealed to him in a dream that this sacred image of Krishna was buried nearby where he was living. So he went to that place, he dug, and he found it and built a temple, which is still there today, which I visited. It's part of the research that I do. Now, some people might say, well, okay, you've got these people in ancient India who were having dreams and visions, and finding physical objects based on those dreams and visions. But that's something completely beyond modern science. Modern science really doesn't engage in that sort of thing. But I found that's also not true. When earlier this year, I was in January, I was attending a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that was held in Jordan, on the Dead Sea in Jordan. It's a major international scientific conference, and I presented a paper there. And the paper was about a scientist named J.T. Robinson, who is well known to archaeologists for his discoveries of fossils of the ape man Australopithecus at the Sterkfontein Caves in South Africa. If you look in any textbook of archaeology, you'll find him mentioned. Now, what's not mentioned in the textbooks is that he took a psychic into the Sterkfontein Caves to help him in his research. He wanted to know more about what these creatures were doing in ancient times. So this psychic was a theosophist named Jeffrey Hodson. This took place in 1961. And Robinson, this very prominent scientist, took this psychic Hodson into the Sterkfontein Caves, and he lay down and went into a psychic trance. And then J.T. Robinson would put a little fossil of Australopithecus or some other ancient ape man on the forehead of this psychic. And then he would have visions in which he would report seeing what the creature looked like, what it was doing millions of years ago. So yeah, I presented this paper, and I actually had photographs of J.T. Robinson and this psychic in the Sterkfontein Caves in South Africa, and the archaeologists were just amazed. You know, they'd never heard of anything like this. One of them said to me, "I've never heard of this before." And I said, "Well, that's why I'm here, to tell you about things you don't already know." And there are many other cases like that also. Actually, a few years ago, I was speaking at a conference in Montreal that was organized by a foundation for science and spirituality there. And one of the other speakers was Stephen Schwartz, who some of your listeners may know.
Oh, sure. Regular.
With the Stanford Research Institute in the 1970s and 80s, doing psychic remote viewing for the United States government intelligence agencies. And after his involvement on that level, he began applying psychic techniques to archaeological work. He did a research project in Alexandria, Egypt, where he and his co-workers were able to psychically locate archaeological discoveries underwater off the coast of Alexandria, Egypt. So it's a topic that I've become interested in recently. As I said, I'm interested in the ancient examples of it, you know, from India and other places, but I'm also interested in the modern scientific application of psychic techniques to archaeology, and Some of the papers in my new books, My Science, My Religion, have to do with that topic.
Michael, do other scientists agree with you, or are you standing out here all by yourself?
Well, fortunately, the world of science is not monolithic. There are different groups of scientists who have different kinds of reactions to what I do. One group I call the fundamentalist materialist or fundamentalist Darwinist. They're very much opposed to what I do. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anyone else to hear it. And they're very dismissive of my work. Sometimes in different countries, they've tried to stop lectures I was scheduled to give at universities and things of that sort. But fortunately, they're not the only group in science today. There's another group of scientists who may be supporters of the current theories, but they're open-minded enough to be able to listen to alternative ideas and consider, well, maybe we might have to change some of our current theories to accommodate new evidence. And it's scientists in that category who have accepted my proposals to present papers at major international scientific conferences. They've also invited me to speak at some of the leading scientific institutions in the world, like the Royal Institution in London and the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow and other scientific institutions. And they've also invited me to give lectures at universities around the world. So I'm not saying that they agree with everything I have to say, but I think it's important that they are willing to listen. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important first step, that scientists, if ideas are going to change, scientists have to be willing to listen to new ideas. Now, among those who do listen, there are some who agree with me. And I'll be honest and say today they are very few in number. But that's sometimes the way things go.
Are they vocal or quiet?
Some of them are quiet. Some of them have written some nice things about me in reviews that they've written about some of my books. So, but many times they're quiet. I mean, once I was invited by a scientist to speak at a major university in the United States. He was in the geology department of this university, and he invited me to speak to the whole geology department, to the professors and graduate students of geology at this university. And I wondered, why did you invite me? Because if you look at the guy, he looks perfectly orthodox. And, he said, well, I heard you on Coast to Coast.
I love it. Michael, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back with you in just a moment. All of Michael's websites, they're linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. He's made the list of dissident scientists. Let's find out what all that means. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Follow us on Facebook. You can like us there and Twitter as well. Simply go to our website. It's in the far right-hand corner. Click the Facebook and Twitter icons, and there you go. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your calls with a forbidden archaeologist, Michael Cremo. Hey, would you like to send us your editorial? You can. Here's the email address, editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Make it about a minute long. Put your name and phone number in there. We'll call you back and possibly record you.
This is Roger from Florida, and this is my sound off. I am one single voice, now slightly above the chorus, of all those presently crying out in the wilderness over a present world order for a fairer and more just, a more enlightened society. Frankly, the time has come for our human race to rise above the old and long outdated survivalist mentality, which mobilizes our major human initiatives toward the basis value of resource acquisition. While we needed to plow hard to set our brow against the untamed earth in order to eke out a living in our primitive past, our world has long attained the capacity to provide for all. If only we might change our heroic landscape from the material to the creative. Every human being must be liberated to contribute to a better world in his and her own unique, non-replicable way, rather than being subjected to the primitive competition for quote-unquote success along materialistic lines. This is Roger from Florida, and this has been my sound off.
Welcome back with Michael Cremo. Michael, of course, why are they calling you the dissident scientist?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I got an email that said I'd been put on the worldwide list of dissident scientists. And, you know, so I looked it up. You know, I searched on the web for worldwide list of dissident scientists, and I found it. And I was on, there are about 4,000 scientists that have made this list. It's not like getting a Nobel Prize in the mainstream world, but it's kind of a recognition, I think, of those of us who are taking unpopular and minority kinds of views in the world of science. So I was trying to find out who was putting this list together. It's put together by a group called Jean de Clément Associates, that's C-L-I-M-O-N-T Associates, and it's explained that this is a synonym for a group of engineers who I guess prefers to remain anonymous. And, you know, sometimes you have to do that in this world. You have to remain anonymous. So I guess whoever's putting this list together is choosing to remain anonymous, but I was kind of happy to be put on it because I am a dissident. That means I'm disagreeing with some mainstream, you know, scientific ideas. And when I looked in the list, I guess the reason they put me in there was because of my work in forbidden archaeology, challenging the Darwinian theory of evolution. So for that, I guess I made the list.
Now, do you travel much beyond this?
Yes, I do quite a bit of traveling. I've got some travel coming up in, you know, the next few weeks. I'll be going to Fort Wayne, Indiana to speak at a conference there. It's called the Ancient Mysteries Conference, and then after that I'll be going to San Francisco to speak at the New Living Expo. That's the weekend of April 26th to 28th. I mean, details about these things can be found on, you know, my website, mcremo.com.
Right.
But I do a lot of traveling. Of course, I'm trying to do a little bit less of it so I can get back to work on the new books that I'm working on. But I still do some traveling. As I was mentioning earlier this year, I was in Jordan for the World Archaeological Congress meeting there. And then after that, I went to India for some research and to attend some meetings there. And I've got a lot of travel coming up this year, including some speaking engagements. In July, I think I'm going to be at an event that you might be at. I'm not sure. In the desert around.
Oh, the one in Joshua Tree?
Yeah, the Joshua Tree.
Yeah, I'll be out
one.
There.
Yeah, the Joshua Tree one in July. So, still traveling.
We're everywhere.
Never going to stop.
I know it. You and I may pass each other one day at an airport, you know?
Yeah.
I want to take some calls with you here, Michael, but I let me ask you about the ancient possibility of a nuclear war. I mean, here's North Korea, you know, with their saber rattling it around here. But didn't Robert Oppenheimer, the founder of our atomic weapon, didn't he get some of his ideas from these ancient ancient Vedas?
Yeah, that's true. In addition to being a great physicist and the leader of the American program in World War II to develop an atomic weapon, he was also a scholar in the Sanskrit language. So he was familiar with the ancient Sanskrit text of India. And when the first atomic bomb was tested, not the weapon that was dropped on Hiroshima, but the first test of the atomic bomb that took place a few months earlier at Alamogordo in New Mexico, he was present. He was in the bunker when the first atomic bomb was set off, tested. And when it went off, he started quoting text from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Because these ancient Sanskrit writings, they also speak of weapons resembling modern nuclear weapons. They were called Brahmastras, and they were sort of the ultimate weapon. And when they would go off, it would be like, according to the descriptions, millions of suns gathered together in one place, which pretty much describes the effect of a nuclear or thermonuclear weapon. So when the first atomic bomb was tested, Robert Oppenheimer began reciting Sanskrit text from the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, describing just that, you know, the light of millions of suns all together in one place. And I've heard that he was asked, what did it feel like to be present for this first atomic bomb explosion? He said, he corrected the reporter who asked him the question, the first in modern times. So I don't think that we are the first to have weapons of this kind. They've been around before.
I sure have. Let's take some calls here for you, Michael. Let's go through John in Tampa, Florida, wildcard line. Hey, go ahead, John.
Thanks, George. I always wanted to ask Michael if he'd heard about the stone anchors, the giant stone anchors with holes along the west coast of Florida, and the matching description of a little city called Tarpon Springs with the Plato's description of the Garden of Eden. With the description matching the location down in Florida and the stone anchors being there, would that mean that Atlantis would be North and South America?
Well, that's some new information for me. The stone anchors existing off the coast of Florida at Tarpon Springs. It's one thing I like about coming on to Coast. I not only get to talk about things that I know, but I get to hear things about what other people know. So that's an interesting piece of information. It's also interesting that off the coast. Yes.
I'm considered a psychic archaeologist, and that's how I was able to locate these stone anchors, but they're not off the coast. They're swept onto the coast.
Oh, they're
8 miles
the coast.
Onto the coast.
Okay.
And so any archaeologist in Florida could have discovered them, but nobody noticed they were giant stone anchors matching the stone anchors up on Mount Ararat where Noah's Ark was.
Yeah, there's also stone anchors found off the coast of the city of Dwarka in northwestern India. And, according to the ancient descriptions, it was a fabulous city. It was the city of Lord Krishna. But 5,000 years ago, it went under the water. So they've also found, anchors and the apparent remains of an ancient seaport off the coast of the present city. So it's kind of interesting that this topic of anchors is coming up, stone anchors. But thank you for bringing that up. It's new information to me. Of course, people have different proposals for the location of Atlantis.
Oh, sure.
There are a lot of different theories about that, and a lot of definitions of what Atlantis was. You know, some people, they look at the descriptions given by Plato in his book, The Republic, and another book. And they regarded that as Atlantis, and they tried to determine where it was in the Mediterranean, in the Atlantic, in near Indonesia, as some researchers are proposing, or in off in the Gulf of Mexico, or off the coast of Cuba, as others are proposing. I'm not an Atlantis expert myself, but I know it's a fascinating topic.
We can assume that regardless of where it was, something probably sank or was there. You agree?
Yeah. Yeah, some people by Atlantis, they mean kind of like a localized island kingdom that went under the sea. And some people have a more broad definition of Atlantis as just some kind of worldwide civilization that existed before the classical Greek and Roman and Egyptian civilization. So people have different ideas about what it was. But whether I think there's a lot of evidence that there were ancient kingdoms that did go under the water. One example is the city of Dwarka in ancient India. And I think there's also evidence for a worldwide human civilization that pre-existed the classical civilizations of the ancient Sumerians and Egyptians and Chinese. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India describe such a thing, a worldwide civilization that gradually broke down into smaller pieces and became more and more limited.
Let's go to Virginia. Jeremy's with us east of the Rockies. Hi, Jeremy. Go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing? I was wondering, you said you were what kind of scientist?
He's an archaeologist.
Archaeologist? And, like...
How about a question, like, Jeremy? What's your question?
My question is, I hear that the pyramids were built from the top down.
Well, I'm not so sure if they were built from the top down. How would you do that, Michael?
Well, how the pyramids were constructed, I think, is still a mystery. You know, so there are, you know, open questions about it. And, you know, that's, you know, I think if what the guest is saying, you know, on the phone here is true, I think if that's true, then you'd have to propose there might have been some kind of psychical construction going on, which I think it's possible, but it certainly doesn't fit in with any of the modern scientific ideas about how things would be constructed. I think if you look at a lot of these ancient monuments, whether we're talking about, you know, the pyramids or Stonehenge and, you know, the British Isles, you know, we're talking about huge, massive pieces of stone weighing tons and tons being moved somehow. And, you know, a lot of, you know, the ancient wisdom traditions give accounts of constructing things where these things are kind of, the stones are kind of floated by mystic powers and things like that. So that's something that I'm open to, but it certainly goes against the modern ways of thinking about these things.
Michael, have you rethought that incredible story you told me 10 plus years ago about those magnetic or those steel balls that were found deep down that had those etchings on it, those markings?
Well, I've always had this opinion about those. Those come from South Africa. They're these round metallic objects. I call them metallic because they're made of hematite, which is a naturally occurring type of iron ore. And the most interesting feature is the parallel grooves that go around them. And know, the position I've always taken is unless somebody can offer a naturalistic explanation of how they could have formed, especially with the parallel grooves that go around the equator, then we should remain open to the possibility that they were made by someone with human-like intelligence. And they're found in deposits. You know, they're found in a mine in South Africa, in deposits that are about over 2 billion years old. So that would be really quite extraordinary. So up to this point, you know, I haven't been able to see any examples of anything that was produced like that by natural forces from anywhere else in the world that exactly resemble these objects from South Africa. I have seen some things that are from the United States. They're called Moki balls, you know, from the southwestern part of the
right.
United States, that are a little bit cruder in terms of their round objects, concretions, that have some kind of groove around the center, but it's very crude, not at all like the very fine, even grooves that are seen going around these objects from South Africa. But I'm always prepared to change my ideas about any of the things that I've reported in my books if somebody gives me a good reason to change those ideas.
Stick around. We're going to come back. A final hour to go. Phone calls with Michael Cremo as we talk about his work, My Science, My Religion, and we'll get into more of that, too, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.